From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Even if you don't know Texas Hold'em from Seven Card Stud, it's a safe bet you've noticed that poker is everywhere these days. It's back from Old West saloons and Dad's poker night in the basement. Poker is huge and ubiquitous on campus, in the casino, on the circuit, in magazines and blogs, and on TV, where millions tune in just to watch. Hollywood's A-list has got game here. Ben Affleck, Don Cheadle, and David Schwimmer ante up on Bravo's Celebrity Poker Showdown.
Don calls.
Hey. Here comes the river.
Wow, it makes two straight for Ben and Don.
And it gets David in big trouble here.
Aces.
He's got a pair of aces.
Check.
Don checked.
3,000, baby. Oh, yeah.
Internet poker is white hot. Nearly $200 million a day bet online. College students are swimming with the sharks, and sometimes are the sharks now, anteing up big bucks in high-stakes games. The payoffs and losses can be staggering. Tonight on Point, poker mania, and America's roaring new infatuation with the bet, the call, the bluff, the game of poker. You can join the conversation. Has the poker boom grabbed you? And what's made poker a national passion again? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Daniel Habib, staff writer for Sports Illustrated. His special report about the internet poker wave on college campuses, online and obsessed, appears in this week's issue. Daniel Habib, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what do you see out there, my friend? What did you find on the web, on the campus?
I found a group of extraordinarily talented, incredibly ambitious young people who have chosen, rather than invest their energies in academic pursuits or in getting iBanking or consulting jobs, to make money playing poker online, and they've done a phenomenal job of it. Many of them have, anyhow.
And I should say, we're going to speak with a couple of phenomenal poker players tonight, one just out of college and another maybe the world's best, it's been suggested. But how has it taken over the campus, Daniel? I mean, I don't remember all my years of college, I don't remember seeing a single poker game. Now it seems to be everywhere. How'd that happen?
I think it's a combination of factors. One is obviously the TV sort of phenomena has driven the boom, just the ubiquity of poker on television. At the same time, you've got people who are living wired. They've got 24-hour internet access. They've got disposable income. And the ability to play at all hours of the day, in many cases under the age of 21, which prevents them from playing in a casino, so the opportunity to play online and do so with impunity. And frankly, they're better than average players for the most part, and so they see it as an opportunity to make money without breaking too much of a sweat.
Paint us a picture. Give us some of the detail of how the college crowd, just for one, and a lot of people are playing poker, not just college kids, but how do they get into it? Are you saying we're not talking about games around tables? We're talking about games at the computer screen on the web? Is that the primary?
Well, yeah, there's overlap between the two groups. And social players will play primarily around tables. They'll play games at fraternity houses or in dorm room basements or in common rooms. But the truly serious players will play online as well. And they'll use that as a laboratory to refine their skills, as a space in which they can master the mathematics of the game, the tactics of the game, and at the same time to sort of learn in a lucrative way. So I would say that everyone who's a serious player is playing both live games and online. You know, the occasional player is playing around a table, but the truly deep ones and the best ones just find the best opportunity for money-making and for theoretical learning.
A lucrative way in money-making. I want to look at that learning because it's very interesting to see that you talk about some of the kids you talk about, though, the college students, about the number of games they can play in the course of a month or a year would have taken, I don't know, many years before. But lucrative? What kind of stakes are we talking about here?
In the course of reporting the story, I probably interacted with one or two dozen serious online players. The best of them were making routinely mid to high five figures, low six figures annually, while sustaining sort of the academic course load of a college student.
Wait, you're saying six figures? That means that starts at $100,000.
That's right.
Now, but I thought in the world of gambling, if you might make $100,000, you might also lose $100,000. What college student can do that?
Well, I encountered college students who did, one anyhow, whom I wrote about at some length.
That's going to show up on mom and dad's credit card with a pow.
Well, actually, it's interesting that a few of the folks I spoke to on the clinical side of things, diagnosing the problem psychologically, pointed to the idea of mom and dad's credit card as, so what is the first thing that a parent does when they send their child off to college? They give them a credit card and say, in case of emergencies, use this.
When you've got a bad hand, you mean?
In a benign way, it gets used for, I don't know, pizza at like 2 in the morning, but really it's a place where a student can get into trouble, particularly if they sort of have immature attitudes about money and about financial responsibility. But the student whom I wrote about, who was down in the range of $55,000, had sort of used all of the really troublesome methods of accumulating capital that problem gamblers fall on. He had borrowed from friends. He had taken cash advances on credit cards. He had been floated cash by his parents. He told me at one point he took a cash advance against his phone bill, which obviously is going to have sort of a close to usury interest rate.
Yeah.
So there are ways to get cash. A gambler is nothing if not resourceful.
Boy, maybe a whole lot of fun, but you're talking about a kind of a big pit of a potential downside there as well. Daniel Habib with Sports Illustrated, please stand by. I want to invite into our conversation from Guilford, Connecticut, Vanessa Selbst. She's just graduated from Yale University, a degree in political science. In the fall, she goes to Spain as a Fulbright scholar, and she is a big-time poker player. Vanessa, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
So I've read a little bit about you, and I hope to learn more right here, but I read that you have made tens of thousands of dollars playing poker during your time at Yale, that your goal is to make $50,000 this summer playing poker before you head off on your Fulbright. I don't recall this as the most widely imagined profile of a Yale kid headed off on a Fulbright. Why poker?
It's just the best game in the world. I mean, there's so much to think about and so many ways to improve. It's just, the money, you think about the money and you're saying $50,000, but really, to me, that's just saying that I want to get X good at this game, and X happens to be $50,000 good at this game. Poker is measured in money, but that has so little to do with it, you know?
Did you make most of your money at a table or at a computer screen?
It's been probably split between the two. I've played a bunch at Yale and also at Foxwoods, but I've played online as well, so you know, it just sort of depends on how I'm running. Online's a lot tougher, but you can, you know, the opponents are much tougher, but you can make so much more money because you're playing 4, 5, 6, even 8 tables at a time sometimes.
8 tables. That means 8 different games of poker at a time.
Exactly.
And how does the online money piece work? Do you shove your credit card number in here before you begin? For those who are uninitiated, how does that work, Vanessa?
Well, there's a number of different options. I mean, I chose to put my, there's a bank account. You can have direct linking into your bank account. And it takes a few days to process, you know, early on when you first start out playing. But as you play more and more with the site, they give you sort of a better deal where right now if I wanted to cash out or deposit, you know, thousands of dollars, it would go instantaneously. So
8 tables at once. Daniel Habib, here's your learning curve. That is a steep one. Presumably, you can get a year's experience in a couple of months there.
That's, and I know Vanessa mentioned this to me, and many other players did as well. Everything is accelerated online, from the volume of hands that can be played to the number of situations that can arise. And while there's a sound theoretical basis to everything that able online players do, there's also an experiential dimension of it that online play provides in a unique way that players of 5 or 10 or 15 years ago couldn't have dreamed of amassing by this age or this point in their poker careers. There's just so many situations that players have seen already just by virtue of playing 8 tables simultaneously.
Wow.
Though Vanessa, how's it going, Vanessa? still surprises me by just the ability to play 8 tables simultaneously, talk to me, talk on the phone, and instant message. So a true multitasker.
So what is it? What is the thrill at bottom, Vanessa? Is it the money Vanessa Selbst is going to make, or is it just the sensory excitement of having 8 tables going at once?
It's definitely, I wouldn't say the sensory excitement of having 8 tables going at once. I mean, if you want to say it's the money in that I have my success measured in something, but it's really just being successful at something that I love to do. I mean, it's basically a game, and it happens to be measured in money, but it's the fact of the matter is, like, it's something that I've you know, spent a lot of time with reading theory, talking to my friends about strategy, you know, playing as many hands as I possibly can within the course of a day. So basically just seeing my improvement over the past few months is really probably the most satisfying thing for me. I mean, that's the way I'm looking at it. You know, I don't know what level I want to reach, but it's just interesting that, you know, to me success, I mean, not even to me, but success in poker is measured in money, and so you know, yeah, that's what makes me happy, but not necessarily because of the things I can buy with it so much as what it shows.
And I don't know, a million questions, but what do Mom and Dad say? That's our girl out there, Poker Stud USA, laying it down, raking in the cash. You get that 50 grand this summer, Vanessa?
Actually, my mom's pretty supportive about it because she used to play a lot in college herself, and she still does play from time. You know, she plays in her weekly game at home and stuff. So she's sort of, it's nice to have her there that she understands. I come home from Foxwoods and I say, "Oh, Mom, I lost $3,000 today," and she understands that, you know, that's not a huge problem. I mean, it's obviously bad news. You know, you don't want to lose $3,000, but you know that it's just sometimes you're going to lose that much because the cards don't go your way, and over the long run, it's not really that big a deal. And it's nice to have someone that understands that and realizes that it's not really gambling. You know, it's just sort of the way the swings of the game go.
Not really gambling. We'll have to look at that. It's great to have an understanding mom when the table goes bad at the casino. Vanessa Selp, stick with us, and Daniel Habib with Sports Illustrated. Vanessa just graduated from Yale. She's headed to Spain as a Fulbright scholar, and she is a big-time poker player, high-stakes gambler. You can join the conversation tonight. We're talking about poker mania. Has the poker boom grabbed you? Are you all in? Has poker taken over your house, your dorm, your computer, your life? Are you a card stud? Are you a net winner, a net loser? What do you say? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about poker mania, about America's roaring new infatuation with the bet, the call, the bluff, the game of poker. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What has made poker a national passion again? And why are we watching poker on TV? Why has it taken over campuses, casinos, and the internet? Are you a player? Do you prefer to play at the table, in person, or on the web? And what's your best new wave poker story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Daniel Habib, a staff reporter for Sports Illustrated magazine, who's looked closely at poker on campus. One of the players, big players, that he's run into there, Vanessa Selbst, is with us as well. She's just graduated from Yale, degree in political science, headed off as a Fulbright scholar, and she loves her poker. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Vanessa Selbst, you have described yourself as a poker addict. What do you mean exactly?
Well, I do it all the time. I mean, I don't know. I've never tested myself to see if I mean, I have actually tested myself to see if I could stop, and I try to, you know, I'll try to stop for a couple days, but then I find myself, you know, if I'm not playing, if I manage to take a two-day break from playing, I'm usually reading about it or reading a book about it or watching it or something like that. You know, it's just a huge part of my life, and I don't know that I could really cut it out if I wanted to.
So are you a problem gambler, or are you just an enthusiast of the game?
Oh,
or can you tell?
An enthusiast of the game. I don't even think poker is gambling, which I'm sure is controversial, but I don't see it as gambling, to be honest with you.
You've got to explain that, Yale graduate. In what sense is it not gambling?
I mean, technically, I suppose you're putting your money in, you're wagering your money, and there's a chance, you know, there's always a chance that you're going to lose your money unless you've got someone, you know, with a 0% chance, which is pretty unlikely. But the fact of the matter is, when you're playing poker, if you're a good player, you know, the more you improve your game, every time you put your money in the center of a pot, you know that your odds are much better than your opponent's. So it's gambling for that hand. If you go in as a 75% favorite in a hand, it's gambling for that hand. One quarter of the time you're going to lose.
Yeah.
But over the long run, you're going to play so many hands that you're going to win three quarters of them, and you know you're going to make money. I mean, statistics show that it's not possible to go in as a 75% favorite 3,000 times and lose money.
Daniel Habib, is Vanessa in denial, or is she onto something here?
I think Vanessa's exactly right, and I learned the hard way not to question her poker expertise. I mean, that's sort of a sidebar to the idea of playing a lot of hands on the internet and volume providing experience. the volume of hands that can be played on the internet also iron out sort of the statistical injustices that create short-term swings in bankroll. Mm-hmm. So when Vanessa says that over 3,000 situations in which she's a 75% favorite to win a hand, she'll make money, she will, because she'll face that situation 3,000 times. It is a controversial position to say that poker isn't gambling, but people who believe that poker is gambling generally are not aware of the mathematical basis of the game, of the probabilistic basis of the game, and of the fact that David Sklansky, who's one of sort of the great poker theoreticians, has an anecdote in the preface to one of his books in which he says that expert players don't rely on luck, they're at war with luck. In essence, that expert players put themselves in statistically favorable situations, mm-hmm. not the opposite. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And yet, we've got millions of people playing now, and they are not all experts. I've got to feel that gamble out there. We'll hear and talk more about that later in the hour. I want to look back at how poker kind of took off. I mean, I've read that sort of the beginning might be traced back of this big wave to this March 2003 when the Travel Channel debuted World Poker Tour. It had poker televised before Daniel Habib, but here they introduced the new element of the hold card cam so that viewers could see what was in each player's hand, and you could kind of effectively look over everybody's shoulder, play along, and out of that, boom.
Right. I believe the first sort of poker telecasts were in the UK. Late Night Poker debuted there in 1999, and ESPN did minimal coverage of the World Series of Poker beginning in 2000 or 2001. The hold cam was interesting, not so much because players necessarily watched along and tried to draw strategic lessons from the game, because for the most part, the hands that were being televised were far above the capacity of the average viewer to appreciate from a strategic perspective. Mm. What it was, sort of in my estimation, was really compelling reality television that everyone could relate to, had more or less played poker, generally understood the rules of the game, and to see bluffs unmasked, to see there's sort of this morbid fascination that comes with watching a train wreck, the hand that you described in the lead-in when somebody makes a straight and somebody else makes a full house on the same card. You know disaster is imminent, and everyone knows it, but the guy who's about to put his head in the lion's mouth.
And you're watching him head right into that buzzsaw. Of course, it didn't hurt 2003 World Series of Poker Chris Moneymaker, improbably named, but true. 27 years old, took home $2.5 million, and that would clearly turn a lot of heads. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. There's a lot of them on the line. Poker players all, I wonder. Sean's calling from New York City. Hi, Sean. You're on the air. How's the game?
Game is great. Cards are flying.
What do you know? What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is why did they raid the poker clubs in New York City last week after Mayor Bloomberg made the announcement that he was thinking about putting poker tables in bars?
Who raided the poker clubs, Sean?
The Vice Squad of the New York City Police Department.
Is poker illegal in New York?
Apparently it is. They said we were raking the pot, which we weren't. A rake is when we take a percentage out of the pot.
Right.
We were a private club who just charged time.
So you charge for time to sit at the table.
Just like the casinos.
Right. And do you have to have a license for that?
Hello.
Can you hear me, Sean?
Yes, I can. Now I can.
Yeah. So did the cops came in and did they shut your club down?
Yes, they did. They shut us down.
Have you been busy before you got shut down? Do you relate to this talk about
10 games going a night?
10 games a night. How many players is that?
That's 100 players.
Okay. And how old is the club? Is it a new thing or?
No. This club was open for... And we had never, ever had a problem.
Well, and down it goes. The police come in. Daniel Habib, can you speak to that?
I heard about that. I'm as confused as Sean is. My interpretation of the law was that it was illegal to profit from hosting a poker game, but that from the player standpoint, it wasn't illegal to play.
Yeah.
Is that right, Sean?
I think we've lost Sean here. Vanessa, do you know? Do you follow the law? You may not.
Yeah.
You've been heading into Foxwoods before you hit legal age, so the law has not been your number one concern here. But do you follow who's up, who's down, where the police come in?
Yeah, I mean, I also attended the New York City Club, so I was a little upset about the raids. But, you know, there's been various interpretations of the law, and many people think that you can just, as long as you're not taking a percentage of winnings, but you're charging sort of a rent for space. If you charge for time instead of a rake from the pot,
yeah.
It can be interpreted as charging, you know, rent for the space and not really profiting from gambling. So I think it's a little fuzzy on that, and no one really ever wanted to deal with it. The police never really did anything about it until very recently. They just raided all these clubs. So I think it's gonna come up pretty soon in the courts, and they're going to have to deal with it at some point because a lot of people are outraged right now.
Let's get another call. Kadra's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Kadra. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a comment, which was that poker, between my friends and I, has increased over the past few years, and it seems to be a reflection of community aspects that now socially, kind of the only things that are marketed to us are video games or videos and not things that cause us to interact with each other. And so now with poker being something that we can all play with each other, it's a social issue, it's a community issue, and it's solidifying in those terms.
So instead of, I don't know, quilting or drinking lemonade, you're playing poker and getting together, socializing.
Correct.
Got it. It sounds like a pretty potent draw there. Daniel, did you see that on the campuses? Is that a big piece of it?
I did, and I was privileged to play in a number of home games, and the players were extremely hospitable to me, and there was a lot of camaraderie around the tables.
I mean, that's,
I wonder, and yeah, probably Vanessa can answer this better than I, whether the prevalence of online play reinforces that community or threatens to sap it.
I think it's exactly the latter, Danny, because you know what? I've had so many situations where I've been the catalyst in the games. You know, we have an email list that goes around on campus, and I'll send out an email to the list at 4 or 5 p.m., you know, asking for a game at 8 or 9 that night. And, you know, the numbers of responses are dwindling. And then when I call them on the phone saying, hey, where are you guys? You know,
right,
come play some poker. They tell me they're playing, you know, sit and goes on their computer, and it's way more profitable to play four tables at a time than to come play with a bunch of people that know how to play.
So that's back to the same old kind of video computer screen isolation that Kadra wanted to get away from there.
Exactly. I mean, that's really, you know, they're measuring their success in profits, and for them it isn't about the social aspects. It really is about the money. And if they can make, you know, $500 an hour, $400 an hour playing online, and they're playing with us, you know, maybe breaking even or something like that, then the answer's pretty clear what they're going to do.
Amazing. Daniel, I've got some questions for you here, just very nuts and bolts. I know you can answer them. First of all, online poker, is it legal?
It's a little bit of a gray area. Technically, from a federal standpoint, it's illegal. But the federal law against internet gambling is never applied to players, but only to site operators.
Okay.
And since all of the for money poker sites online are chartered outside the U.S., it's not applicable. There's only one instance of an individual citizen being prosecuted for making an online wager, and that individual paid a $500 fine. From a practical perspective for players, it's illegal, but it's kind of like jaywalking.
But it sounds like you could get a different prosecutor in there who could get real tough on it, but that just hasn't happened.
It's just from a law enforcement standpoint, it's a very low priority.
Who runs most of the poker sites online?
The majority of the sites are run by sort of gaming conglomerates. The largest one, Party Poker, is run by Party Gaming, which is chartered in Gibraltar, but which is about to move to the U.K., where online poker has just been legalized.
One of the owners there, Ruth Parasol, you report, 38-year-old Californian who made her fortune in internet pornography and then moving on to poker.
So clearly she understands that the internet is good for exactly two things now.
Right. And what about taxes? I mean, Vanessa's winning some pretty big money. Others maybe even bigger online. Do players have to pay taxes on winnings, whether they're online or at the table?
Mm-hmm. Well, at the tables, it's less of an issue because casinos are reporting winnings. And so the IRS is getting wind of a significant – this is winnings and sort of like, you know, the five and major tournament winnings. So players there are going to have to declare. Theoretically, players who win online do have to declare. But again, the sites aren't reporting to the IRS. So there's not necessarily a reason to believe you'll be caught if you don't. It's sort of one of those ethical gray areas.
Vanessa, how's your tax return look?
Well, I have something interesting to say about that, which is that it's really, you know, it's really interesting on, depends on, I think that the whole question of taxes on gambling is An interesting question, and I think it should sort of relate to how often you play. And the reason I would say this is because, for me, you know, I plan on, obviously, if I keep up winning the way I am, filing a tax return with my poker winnings. But they tax you on net winnings. So if I were to have a net $50,000 a year, I'd have to file that tax return. But the following year, if I were to have, you know, a $30,000 losing year, well, you know, they're not going to let me file to the IRS and then give me back the taxes, you know.
Hey, crocodile tears, that's just like business, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not exactly, but pretty much.
Well, I mean, sort of, but the whole point of this game is that there are swings. And the reason I say it would be fair, I think it would be a lot more fair for the players that are high volume, is the variance issue I was talking about before. If you're playing enough per year, that there's no way that you're going to have a very different year, one year to the next, like, you know, big players are playing, then I think it's perfectly legitimate. But if you're playing a very high-stakes game but a low number of hands, it's very feasible that you could have a winning session, and when I say session, I mean year, one year, and then the very next year have a losing year. And, you know, just because the taxes are done annually, I don't think that that necessarily should factor in. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. You're asking for a lot of subtlety from the old IRS there on the gaming front. Let's get a call. Matt is calling from Holden, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, it was funny when I heard this topic because I don't gamble, and that comes from my father, who told me that, you know, never to gamble. And I always thought that was a big, just a moral principle with him.
At one time it was in the whole country, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think because we learned a lesson that we've forgotten. Because I just, he told me recently that the reason he was always told not to gamble was because his father, my grandfather, when they were living in South Dakota, he saw people lose their ranches, their homes, over the gambling table. And it was that practical lesson that taught him never to gamble.
Now, Matt, what do you think? In an age when players like Vanessa can play 8-10 tables at one time and rack up a huge volume and kind of gauge their statistical success rate, you know, over a long arc of time, does it change the risks in poker, the risks in this stripe of gambling?
Yeah, it sounds like Vanessa has got it worked out so that, you know, with the volume of games she plays, she can play the percentages. But it's funny, she's finding out in the small at Yale, she's not getting many people to play with her, and as more and more people lose money to people like Vanessa, she might have trouble finding people to play.
Yeah, work down the food chain, because it really does depend, all those big winnings depend on somebody losing. Matt, thanks for your call. Vanessa, what about it? Here you are, fresh college grad, right out of Yale. When you think this through ethically, all the way down to the losers who are required to make your winnings, and not losers who, you know, who are out trying to, build a railroad or a business or a farm, but they're just gambling and they lose. Can you make the ethical case for gambling right down to bottom? Are you no different than a stockbroker or a hedge fund trader?
I don't think that, for me, it's not an ethical issue because these people are coming, you know, voluntarily to play these games. And for a lot of the people I'm playing with, they're actually just extremely rich businessmen who, you know, want to have the entertainment of going to the poker table at the casino and throwing away a few $1,000 to them isn't really that big a deal. I mean, that's not the majority of players, but that is some of the players. And, you know, I mean, so it is a voluntary thing, but, you know, if it were one of my friends, you know, saying earlier, if it were one of my friends at the table and they were coming and I knew they were consistently winning money they didn't have, well, yeah, then I would have an ethical issue gambling with them. But
you don't know about who's playing at the other end of the internet line.
Exactly. I mean, it's just easier when it's more anonymous, you know, if you don't know the players you're playing with.
So that comes back to the ethical issue. Are you just harvesting a bunch of kind of, you know, suckerfish out there?
Well, I mean, it is a zero-sum game, and it is, you know, I mean, that's what it is. So if you think that I'm, you know, if you think that poker players are sort of, you know, sort of sucking the money, you know, it seems more like an involuntary thing. And I guess some who, you know, talk about addiction and gambling addictions would argue that it is, but to some extent, at least it is voluntary on their part. So I don't see too much of an ethical issue with it.
Vanessa, what's the best hand you ever played? What's the best pot you ever pulled in?
The best pot I ever pulled in. Oh, well, I was at one time I was at Foxwoods. I was playing the 5-10 no limit, and I hit a board of quad eights versus aces full of eights. So, needless to say, I got my opponent stacked. So, it's pretty hard to get away from the second best hand when it's aces full. So I took in a $3,500 pot right there.
Wow, you left me in the dust in a hurry with that. but is it all Texas Hold'em?
No, I've played. We used to play Omaha Hold'em at our Putnam and Omaha Hold'em at our home game, which is like Texas Hold'em, but instead of two hole cards, you get four. And, you know, I think the truly best poker players are very versatile because, you know, I enjoy learning other games because I think that it really helps you with your poker strategy because all poker has similar strategy in that it's all about odds and folding equity and bluffs and, you know, everything like that. And it all factors into every game. So if you can excel at many different types of poker, I think that that's the way you really get better.
Wow, what a picture. The Yale grad hit off on a Fulbright and taking her poker expertise right there with her. Vanessa Selbst, Daniel Habib with Sports Illustrated, please stand by. We're talking tonight about poker mania, poker everywhere, poker gone mainstream, gone glam, gone to college, to the web, about poker all over. You can join us. Is this all in good fun, or is there a dark side here? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about poker everywhere. Poker gone mainstream, gone glam, gone to college, to the web, about poker all over in the United States these days. I'm joined tonight by Daniel Habib. He's a staff writer for Sports Illustrated. He wrote the story in the current issue online and obsessed about poker on campus. One big campus player is with us tonight. Vanessa Selbst just graduated from Yale, degree in political science. In the fall, she goes to Spain as a Fulbright scholar. She's a player. You can hear it. You can also join us tonight. What do you think? Has poker taken over your house, your dorm, your computer, your life? Are you a poker addict? Do you know someone who is? And what's the meaning, the explanation for the great poker comeback in America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Harold is joining us calling from Hurley, Wisconsin. Hi, Harold. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, I'm glad I got in because I've dialed.
Good to have you here. It's not easy to get in here, but we're glad to have you.
Well, it's I would like to have a little bit more information about the lives that have been ruined by gambling. Now, I live up in Hurley, and we have Native American gambling in several casinos.
Right.
And I know one particular person that committed suicide after getting in debt so far through gambling. We have Gambling Anonymous up here.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there's, and to me, college is a poor place for young people, maybe inexperienced gamblers, and they get a little bit in debt, and they get desperate, and they gamble, and they lose. Like I say, I know people that have lost everything through gambling. And I think an adult or somebody 30, 40, 50 years old or whatever that wants to gamble, that's their choice. But to get it going in college and to be a popular sport, I think there should be some little more emphasis on the negative side of gambling.
Harold, we hear you loud and clear, and I appreciate your call. Maybe to help us do that, let's turn right now to another guest I want to bring on tonight. Jeffrey Derevinsky joins us. He's joining us from Montreal. He's a psychologist and professor of psychiatry at McGill University. He's co-director of the International Center for Youth Gambling and High-Risk Behavior. Jeffrey Derevinsky, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
You hear the call right there from our caller in Wisconsin saying he's got a friend who committed suicide. He's seen people take a tough road here in their hands of poker. You've looked at it in particular with regard to young enthusiasts for the game. What do you see, good fun or problem, both?
I think it's both. And I think there, as Vanessa was talking about earlier, for every winner, there's a whole bunch of losers out there. And most young people are getting involved for a variety of reasons, for the enjoyment, for the socialization, for the excitement that gambling is bringing. Nevertheless, having said that, there's a very small but identifiable population of youth who get overly involved. And that leads to a variety of serious problems, and including suicide attempts. And there have been clearly a number of indications that young people have committed suicide directly as a result of their gambling problem.
We'll get down to those stories, but let me ask you the broad question first. How do you explain the enormous boom, comeback in poker? I mean, poker's been around a long time, but it hasn't been this big in many years, maybe never, as a portion of society playing it. What forces do you see having brought that back, Jeffrey?
I think a number of things have occurred, and I think Daniel's mentioned some of them. I think the whole phenomenon started really with Chris Moneymaker, who looked like a young kid. Many of the tournament champions are fairly young now.
And that they big pot, jeans. Talking millions for these young players, and it's all on TV, so there's a big icon to look at.
Exactly. And I think television has brought poker into the home. And many young adolescents and young adults are studying this in terms of trying to improve their skills. And this has become very, very popular, not only in the United States, but around the world.
And what about Vanessa's take on this? She's saying, look, she says, I'm addicted, but I'm addicted because it's so fascinating. And she says, this is not gambling. I play at such a high scale of games that I know what my odds are. So it's a rational game to her.
Well, certainly the poker has a fair amount of skill involved, and it's built on probability theory. It's built on finesse. It's built on the ability to read other players as well. But with respect to gambling, you're still dealing cards in a random fashion, and there is probability that you will not win. And unless you have a large enough bankroll, then you're going to be in potential trouble. Clearly, when one defines gambling, it's wagering money in order to win money. So that's, you know, poker would certainly fall within that domain.
No question. A lot of callers want to join. Let's turn to them. Max is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Max. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a few points to make. The first was that I think that it's the media's positive portrayal of these players, which has sort of boosted this boom of poker, like, because there's many players that have this, like, they're very charismatic, so I think it makes the public believe that, I don't know, like, when they show them on TV, they're very funny and...
Absolutely, and they get all the camera close-ups, and you see them playing, you got David Williams and Phil Ivey and John Wanda, Texas Dolly Brunson, they're celebrities.
Yeah, and another point that I was hoping to make was I do think that it is gambling to an extent, because as it was just said, that there are cards being dealt that you have no control over, but at the same time, there's a psychological effect to the game that truly takes skill. So I think it's both gambling and isn't gambling.
Are you a player yourself, Max?
Yes, I am.
And if you won or lost?
I win most of the time, actually.
Yeah, and are you like, do you wish you could play more, or do you wonder sometimes, wait a minute, what am I doing here?
Well, I kind of wish I could play more at times, but I am also glad that I'm not addicted to the game, because I'm actually doing a project right now in school about poker, and so I've looked kind of deeply into the dangerous effects of poker, and that sort of showed me what getting addicted can do. So I'm sort of glad that I don't get addicted to the game, but I also enjoy it a lot.
Well, watch out. Don't go to the downside there, Max. Thanks for your call. Let's get another call here from Los Angeles. Phil is calling. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing there?
We're good. What do you think?
I just was going out to get some flour, and I caught the radio station. I was like, hey, wow, cool. And then you gave the number, and I thought I would chime in and tell you something that I think is important for America to know.
Are you a poker player, Phil?
Yes. My name is Phil Locke. My nickname is Unabomber. I've been on three or four televised poker tournaments on the World Poker Tour.
So you're a famous poker player of sorts. And what do you think? What should we know?
The thing that the TV, people come away with this impression that, wow, look at all the winning that's happening. Look at all the winning that's happening. I play the tournaments. I end up on TV occasionally after, you know, you best something like 300 people and you get to the final table.
Right, you got
to
work your way in there.
But the bread and butter of poker are the money games, and something that you don't see on TV is the heartaches that go along with the people that aren't as clever and don't play with gambling theory concepts in line with, they're not appropriating bankroll management techniques to limited bankroll. So you see a lot of losing, and you see a lot of people who don't belong at a poker table. I mean, hey, it's great. The pros can't earn without weaker players there, but that's the one thing that is never, I've never heard on a talk show or a TV thing or anything about how no one ever really addresses no one really is ever addressing the just the massive amount of losing that has to happen for these people to be popping off, oh, I made $300,000 last year on the side, or I made
Right. The downside, on the other side, the losers. Phil in California, in Los Angeles, thanks a lot for your call. Jeffrey Derevinsky, there's the warning from a pro or something like it, saying, he's seen firsthand everybody that's got to lose to fill that pot. But yet you feel the resistance to really looking at this in moral terms. That seems passé, like something that the country did historically, not today.
I think the industry itself has done an enormous marketing job in changing the whole notion of gambling to gaming. Where else could you have seen Sports Illustrated take a look at this as a sport? We are now no longer have a negative connotation of gambling. It's no longer that sinister game underground, but really we've brought it to the forefront. And the industry has gone very strong into making this a form of entertainment. No different than, in fact, spending time going to the movies or to the theater. And as a result of that, the whole notion of gambling as a normalized activity, with more and more states engaged in the development of casinos, more and more states looking at alternative ways to gamble in order to increase their revenues, they are the ones that are, in fact, the most addicted.
Mm. Vanessa Selbst, talk with us about the future for a minute. Here you are. You've got a fresh political science degree out of Yale. You're headed off as a Fulbright scholar. What role do you see gambling playing in your future? Is this a lifetime sideline, occupation? Can you imagine ever not gambling? Can you imagine, having a moral crisis one day and deciding that's the wrong way to invest your energy? Or is this something you're going to do the rest of your life?
Right. I mean, obviously coming out of college at this time, I've thought a lot about that. I mean, next year, I'm glad. I actually just found out I got the Fulbright a couple weeks, like a week ago, so it was pretty great news, A, because I got it, but also because it would allow me to play poker. The other option...
How does a Fulbright allow you to play poker?
Because the other option that I had was going to work at a consulting firm, which is obviously a lot more intensive than doing independent research.
So you're going to sit in Spain on a Fulbright playing poker with people all over the world?
Well, I'm not really going to, I'm not going to play online as much over there, but I am going to play, in casinos and maybe a little bit online. It won't be the main thing I'm doing. I'm going to focus on my research. And
I hear William Fulbright spinning in his grave,
and see Spain and everything like that. But, in the future, I don't want to make a career out of it. I think that there are far better things you could do for yourself, for others. Eventually, I do want to work as probably a lawyer, some sort of, I did an internship this semester at Amnesty International, and that's sort of the line of work that I want to get into.
So when do you stop? When you make your first million? When you lose your first million? What's the borderline?
I stop when I run out of time or when it stops being fun. It doesn't really, factor. I mean, obviously, if I were to lose a lot of money, I would stop playing, but it doesn't really work like that. I mean, the stakes that I'm playing, you get to a point where you can beat the stakes you're playing at, and then you move up in stakes. And if you continue to beat the stakes that are higher, then you move up again. And it's like Phil was talking about with bankroll management. You wait to move up in stakes until you have enough money to cover the variance. So it's sort of not really feasible that I'm going to lose all the money. And maybe that's naive of me or something. I'm sure a lot of people are thinking. But I think that I'll stop when it stops being fun or I stop having time. But I definitely don't want to make it into a profession. I don't think that it's really a... feasible. I mean, you don't really want to spend all your time in casinos your whole life,
There's a lot of confidence talking and a lot of years stretching out forward. Jeffrey Derevinsky, what about socially? Is there a break point here, or does society just take on a new degree of chance, of gaming, of gambling, and live with it?
I think there is going to be some saturation point. I don't think we've reached that saturation point, and I think people will continue to gamble because it's an enjoyable activity. It has many pro-social aspects to it as well. My concern is that someone like Vanessa is a role model in the sense that she graduated Yale, has a Fulbright scholarship, and is still able to concentrate playing a long number of hours gambling. I, on the other hand, have had individuals come in for treatment who have dropped out of college because their entire focus has been on gambling and playing poker in particular, and as a result, they no longer were able to function in class, they failed classes, and are now no longer in school.
So watch out, friends. Know when to hold them, know when to fold them. Jeffrey Derevinsky at the McGill University, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Daniel Habib with Sports Illustrated, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks very much for the tour.
Thank you.
And Vanessa Selbst, we can only wish you good luck, and thanks for sharing so intimately with us tonight.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
In a moment, we'll hear from the newly elected mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa. This is On Point. The newly elected mayor of Los Angeles took his message to a national stage today, speaking to the progressive group Campaign for America's Future in Washington. Last month, Antonio Villaraigosa became the first Latino mayor of L.A. in over a century, catapulting himself into the national spotlight. Today, he urged his audience to forge a new definition of family values, one based on care for the poor, the homeless, and the hungry. Here's an excerpt from his speech.
A measure of a great society is not what we do for the rich and powerful, because every society in the history of the world is done great by the rich and the powerful. It's what we do for the children, what we do for those who don't have a voice. I'm unabashedly a progressive. And some... But I'm not a knee-jerk either. And I say that because sometimes we fail to understand. You take people where they are and you try to move them to your direction. You don't go so far out in front of people that they don't feel that you're connected with them. We've got to understand that part of building a movement to reclaim America is to understand the strategy and tactics of where we need to be today so that we can be somewhere else tomorrow. We've got to identify the issues that we can create a common ground all across the country. I've said that neither party, in my opinion, is talking about an urban agenda. Neither party is talking about revitalizing cities. We don't see a commitment to economic development in communities that have been left behind, that are so critical to raising up the standard of living and addressing the divide between rich and poor. In Los Angeles, I've said, a great city is a city where we're growing and prospering together. That idea resonated in the San Fernando Valley as much as it did in South Los Angeles. It wasn't an idea that was threatening to people, because as they thought about it, they realized, if we're not doing something about the fact that so many of our kids are dropping out in Los Angeles, where the majority, 60% of Latinos are dropping out, 57% of African Americans, if we're not doing something about those kids, all of us will be impacted. They won't be able to support our Social Security system. They won't be able to pay into that system so that we can keep it solvent. We'll have more kids in prison instead of moving on to institutions of higher learning. We've got to get beyond the rhetoric and focus on the common ground and focus on the things that people care about.
The mayor-elect of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, speaking earlier today in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.